So we're here today. It's May 6th, 2024. I'm joined today by Louis Rocha in San Jose, California, and Debbie Goldman in DC, I'm guessing, and Hannah Goldman in Brooklyn. So we're covering the coast, the Midwest. So we've got them all on board.
And Jeff, why don't you enter
Oh, and I'm
just
Jeff
mention your
Beckerbach.
name?
Yeah.
Thanks. Save it. Let me stop and say it.
Yeah. I'm Jeff Reckenbach, the retired Secretary of Treasury of the Communication Workers. So, Louis, this project, as Debbie's explained to you, is just trying to collect oral histories from some key leaders, and it wouldn't be complete without talking to the legend that you are, particularly your experiences on the West Coast are just too many to mention. So we're hoping we can get to as many as possible over the next couple of hours here. So before we get into your CWA career, though, let's just take a couple of minutes and talk a little bit about your upbringing. When were you born? Where? Siblings? That sort of thing. Just for a little background.
Thank you. Yes. Well, I was born November 8, 1957. My mother always called me an election day baby because my birthday always came around election day, or maybe a few days off, several years. But I was born in San Jose, California. It's been my hometown pretty much since I was born, and I actually live a few miles from the old neighborhood where I grew up and where my grandparents had a little ranch. So I'm one of the last remaining family members, though, in the area, but still here.
Any siblings?
Yeah, I had two sisters and one brother, and
And where are you in the pecking order?
so I'm the third from the oldest. So we actually had family had two older sisters and one younger brother.
Okay, cool. And what did your parents do for a living?
So my father was Louis Rocha Sr., and he was born in Fresno, California, and he was a he got into trouble after coming out of getting back from Korea. He ended up in San Quentin prison, but fortunately, when he came out of prison, he was able to find work. In fact, he got his act together by becoming first a Teamster and later a union carpenter. And that actually was it later impacted my life a lot. And knowing that for many of the challenges in our community, having a good union job is the solution for many of our social ills. And I can talk later about his challenges within his union and their strategy, the carpenters and so on. My mother was actually a Teamster as well. I'm actually a third generation union member. My grandparents were also union. Most of them, my grandfathers were railroad workers, and my grandmother, one of my maternal grandmother, was also a Teamster. They were all my aunts, my mother, grandmother, they all worked in canneries. Later, after they moved from the fields, they moved into cannery work as they settled in more urban areas, California.
So the trade union movement is in your genes, apparently.
It is that actually there it was pretty well in I want to say we were pretty well versed in how unions operate, but also more importantly what their purpose was, because my aunts, uncles, cousins, growing up, my mother's siblings, they were in the UAW, they worked at the Ford plant, they were at General Motors, uncles were letter carriers, they worked at Lockheed. The goal in our family growing up, the people that had a decent living had purchased homes, had new cars, had, lived the American dream. Those that were fortunate to have a union job, which back in the late 50s and 60s was largely the majority, at least in my family. It was a very union extended family, and all that went with it because there was a lot of discussion, especially with the UAW, because my uncle was uncles were businessmen and or committee men, I think the word was that they used. And with all that was going on in the 60s with the farm workers movement, we were active. They were active. We were, as supportive in supporting the farm workers. It wasn't just their union focus. And that's the other lesson that I learned. The sole, trade or whatever industry they were part of, it was for the community. And that's something learned early on, lobbying and agitating for a street. Improvements and putting gutters and sidewalks in many of the impoverished areas that our families lived in. Even though they were middle class, you still or considered middle class at that time. That there the infrastructure in the city, there was poor lighting in the neighborhood. There was a lack of safety with the road improvement, sidewalks, gutters. When it rained, many of the streets, they were the sidewalk that were just it was a mess. So but that's like a more I think broader view of what the family role. The one thing I need to mention though, my family, my parents also suffered. My father was an alcoholic. And my mother had suffered from, mental illness as well as alcoholism. And so, even though they were union, and that's what I often raise, and it was really good to find out from through CWA our focus on serving the community and community services, because I gravitated toward that United Way and other work in the union. To support that because of what I experienced and knew, was through no fault of my parents, but they were, they won that lottery that no, you don't want family members to win. That basically leads to a lot of, let's just say stress and trauma. But
So where
Can
did
I
you go to school?
ask
Yeah,
can
go
I
ahead.
ask a couple questions? What union were the cannery workers?
So they were the cannery workers. That's their name, but they were affiliated with the Teamsters. So we call them Teamsters, but the cannery workers union was offshoot of the Teamsters.
This was your grandparents, so this was
Well,
back in the 30s and 40s.
so my mother's family moved during the Depression from Arizona to California. And they settled in San Jose, 1940, I believe it was, and they found employment. They had been working in the fields, from Arizona to through California, but they settled in San Jose because one of my uncles had a connection with a ranch that was fairly large. It was called the McCarthy Ranch in San Jose, where he in well actually Milpitas, and so they had a connection, a family friend that was there. So the family came and they were working in the fields pretty until they got the work in the canneries. So the cannery work didn't begin until the early 40s. My mother was not; she was in grade school then, but my grand. Mother and my mother's older sisters were found work in the canneries. It was during World War II, especially, and then with because there was a labor shortage more or less, and in certain industries, and that was one the where they were able to find work. So it wasn't until the 40s. Although you're right, the cannery workers they had been trying to organize them since the 1920s, what I understand, in the Santa Clara Valley, it had been a long, long fight to get them organized. I guess after 35 is when they were successful. And
The reason I was so interested is my mother-in-law was a organizer with a union called, she called UCAPAWA, UCAPAWA, United Cannery Agricultural something P workers something, a very left union.
Yeah,
And
they're
there's a there are some very interesting books, including an oral history of her about her organizing with UCAPAWA. A lot of women cannery workers.
so the joke in our family, well, my family weren't leaders per se in the other than the UAW, other unions, postal, but in the cannery worker, they were not in leadership roles or but a joke was, in our family, they would forgive you if you cheated on, your spouse, but if you crossed the picket line, you were done in our family.
Wow.
Scab was not, you're not forgiven. In fact, that was the worst shame you could get render, someone scab. It just didn't happen in our
Yeah.
family,
And it sounds like from Arizona and then California, you've got some deep roots. What's your grandparents' and your parents' ethnic background?
So my grandparents, both sides, are Mexican heritage. They both, my grandfathers, both came during World War I. My great grandfather on my father's side found employment with the railroad, as well as his son. My grandfather, my father's family came north from El Paso, Texas, and then moved over worked their way toward California and eventually settled in Fresno. That's where my father's family has been since 19, I believe it was 1916,
Wow.
1918, somewhere around there, because one of the first births of my father's oldest sibling was in Fresno, and I believe that was in 1919. So they had to been there already. And then my mother's family came from through Arizona. My grandfather had been, he was born in 1890. And actually, I was blessed to know him. He was a man of all trades, a cowboy, vaquero. He found employment in the railroad industry. And actually, both of my grandfathers, their pension that they earned from the railroad actually tied the families over during the Great Depression, helped them, get through some tough years. But my grandfather, on my mother's side, had been working in the U.S. since, I believe, 1905, but brought my grandmother and across, and they believe it was 1920 when they came up through Sonora. And settled in. They had lived in the Gila River Indian Reservation, because at that time they weren't accepted. Mexicans were the bottom of the ladder, and so they survived on Indian reservations with where they were accepted and labored alongside the native tribes and. But they came from Arizona in the 1940. My aunt, my oldest aunt, my tia, had married a Filipino American, and he's the one that they had met in the field. And just a little bit, this is part of the complex diaspora of American, immigration. The Filipinos could not bring women with them when they immigrated. So, and this is true throughout in the 19. 15 to 1940 or 50 time period, many Filipino Americans married Hispanic, Native American, white, black women, because they couldn't, couldn't bring their because of immigration laws. So my aunt married a Filipino man who had served in the U.S. Cavalry. That's how he got from the Philippines here. And they met up, and long story short, he's the one that brought our family, because Filipino and Mexican immigrants have a long history working in the field, as other people do. The legacy of the agribusiness industry in this country is pretty storied. But my uncle's the one that brought the family. And I might add that my mother always, told us, in the labor camps, her best friends were from Oklahoma or Arkansas. In fact, one of my sister's name is Deborah Jean, and but he asked her, like, because my name, the real name is Luis Hernandez Rocha, and my brother's Francisco, but my sister's Deborah Jean, and that was my mother's best friend in the camp. She was a what they call an Okie, or apologize if that's derogatory, but that was part of that her upbringing, but that she loved the names of her friends that who happened to be white, and that she played with and were her best friends.
It's a
Yeah, I
great
may be
rip.
rambling a little, so rein me in if you guys need to.
I have a
That's what this is all about. Please ramble.
I have just a one word question, a yes or no. Did you speak Spanish in the home, and do you speak Spanish?
So that's a complex question. My parents, I was blessed to know my great grand maternal grandmother, which only spoke Spanish. My grandfather only spoke Spanish, mostly. But we could not speak Spanish. We were disciplined or instructed. We were told, because my parents were disciplined when they were growing up, my father in Fresno, my mother in San Jose. They were punished if they spoke Spanish, so they didn't want us to experience that. They're of that generation that they were traumatized by their experience with that. So we had to understand it, but we couldn't speak it. And so and that actually led to many of my generation that and my kids were very bothered by that, because I couldn't teach them. It just that was really stuck in my head, because my parents wanted us to succeed, and their parents, my grandparents, and that was just taboo because of the, really the trauma that they faced in school, when they spoke it, and that really did hurt my father, because he loved, his family, his parents, obviously, and. But when he went to school, he was quickly taught, no, you don't speak that here.
So, where did you wind up going to school?
So I went to school in East San Jose, pretty much.
Public
So my
school.
dad, my father and mother, of course, we were living the American dream. They bought a house in East San Jose for, I believe it was $12,000. With these working class mass neighborhoods that when San Jose was booming in the 50s and 60s, they actually were able they bought two new homes, had new cars. I remember us going to Disneyland, just incredible. It was a good time with all the social ills, everything going on. I don't want to romanticize what was the period like, but for the family, it was a good time. And I went to school in East San Jose, elementary school. I believe it's Alum Rock School District, and I actually spoke there a few months ago at some event, the community rally, and I actually share that that's where I learned my si se puede attitude in the 60s, late. No, it was 1970. We actually had a school walkout in middle school. We were protesting the lack of Chicano and Mexican teachers, the lack of history of our history being shared with the other student being taught, and other things. That was my exposure first, probably time getting active with community groups and fighting for because I remember picketing. While I was in middle school, we were picketing Kmart, for example, because they didn't have they would only hire Hispanic janitors. For example, Bank of America didn't have any tellers and so on. And so there was a that's it was in the school as well with my family and other, influences that got me active. And there's been no turning back since. I graduated from Overfelt High School in 1975 in East San Jose.
Yeah, that's remarkable. I mean, junior high school to be an activist like that.
Well, in high school, I was named the mo one of, I forgot the troublemaker. I forgot the word they called it. Most liberal or lib, because we actually went on a field trip when Reagan was governor, and we actually got in trouble because we were spitting loogies at the window and throwing. So, and he actually remember they called us in, brought us in, and he gave us jelly beans or something. I don't remember, but I actually, and this is nothing, not something that I'm not proud of, but part of my reputation, I stole ashtray holder from the governor's mansion, so I still have it. Maybe come and get me. I mean, it's, I don't know, maybe the statute of limitations has, but that's my connection with Reagan. I've got his ashtray holder, so
Maybe Newsom will give you a pardon.
yeah, there.
Jeff, do you know what it means, spitting loogies?
Yeah.
I don't. Can you t is it clean? Can you tell us
Oh,
on a
sure. Yeah, go ahead, Louis. Go
what
ahead.
it's
Yeah,
spitting?
so it's spitting up the phlegm in your throat Oh,
and throwing
yeah.
it,
Oh, spitting. It's yeah. But it's the stuff that's deep in there. It's the colored stuff. Yeah, not just the clear.
The high school, though, was very, and this is all what led to my like macro vision of the world, because I was always on the edge. I was part of that, could go end up like my father, and I was always struggling with that, whether I would take the wrong path in life. And but I was fortunate to have one teacher that was incredibly just committed to the field and the community. She actually, her name was Janet Espinosa. She was a white lady married to a Hispanic male, and she actually saved me my education, this potential. She was a math teacher, and she always had a bright mind. I had potential, I guess. My mother said when I was a baby that I would read the phone book. And mind you, that was the only, it was either the Bible or the phone book. I mean, there weren't too many books in our house that I recall. But the Janet, the reason why I point her out and will always be remembered as one of my favorite influential teachers was because she taught calculus and trigonometry, and she actually lived in my neighborhood a few blocks from me. So she when I was in high school, when it, she had a pool table in her garage, so we wanted to always go over there, play pool, and but the thing was we had to do our homework. And so she taught, and I excel was one of the few Chicano kids. In fact, growing up, I was half my friends didn't graduate. The dropout rate was probably 50%. Most of my friends, in fact, I was one of the few that graduated from high school. But that my mother was, stick education. We, with the was critical or was always stressed. But Janet, so we would do that. In fact, she got me through some rough times when I was having with my family. But the great thing though is later she ran a math institute, so all of my sons and daughters went through this math institute with her, and they all excelled and got through their high school. And so it just it was just such she was just such a special person, and I give credit to her wherever I can for her passion and just going above and beyond with the students in the at the school she taught at in our neighborhood. Because most of the teachers didn't live in the neighborhood. They like everyone else, they moved on to where they would rather be raising their families.
So, have you been able to share these thoughts with her as well?
I did the last time. I don't know. We've lost contact. She did follow. She came to my graduation when I graduated from college. I've seen her. I saw her when I would take my kids. In fact, there was another teacher that was pretty cool. Tim McDonough. 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 Something. But he became the principal of the high school in the good neighborhood where I eventually, moved my family to. So it's been I've gone full circle, at least with the teachers that I had, were really good connection or real, they were influential in my formation. But yeah, I could go on and talk
No.
about, yeah,
So
that.
you mentioned two books in your house, the phone book and the Bible. So what was your religious upbringing like?
Oh, híjole, that's yeah. My father was Catholic, my mother was Protestant, so we did double duty, which was at times just and probably why I'm secular now. I'm more I believe strongly in the division of church and state, but that and I look back, it was their view, their although we didn't really like it, Sundays sometimes we went to both churches, and but my grandparents were very religious. My father's Catholic and my mother's Protestant.
So, after high school, what's your next move?
So this was so part of the tragedy of my life, the conflict. It was my senior year in high school. I believe it was either 1974 or 75. I got into trouble with a gang and they attacked my house. My mother was there and we, a friend, were able to survive. Came pretty serious, actually dodged several serious encounters with people that let's just say they didn't have good intentions. And so my father had divorced in the late 60s. So my mother was there trying to keep it together for all of us, and she had to move because I had just been the contra you know contradictions. I had been accepted to the University of Santa Clara and the University of California at Santa Cruz, and I had two schools options. So I was leaving to go to UC Santa Cruz, and I wouldn't be there to take care of my mother, and she just lost it and left and moved in with her parents because it just was not, it wasn't safe. And that's part of the, like I said, the duality of a lot of, just surviving the people that I had issues with that had issues with me. Of course, they didn't have good union job. They were running the streets and looking for trouble. And, I just happened to cross their paths. And so that it's one of the bittersweet moments. My mother loved her that little house that her and my father had, gotten, and it was so yeah. And that's not a proud moment in my past because I do have, that's I'm a flawed, person, and that's part of my legacy. And it and I did work my best to make it up to my mother. She actually, before she passed, she lived with us. I took care of her and did the best and I could to make her make amends. But it was pretty traumatizing for her, that whole experience.
She had to be pretty proud of you going on to college, though. I mean, I would think that would have been a big
Yeah.
deal.
I was the first in my family to go to college, and but I'll get to that because that's an interesting story. I tell you, it's been a unique, pretty wild at time journey. But yeah, she
So get
was.
to it. Go for it.
So, I had been accepted to a couple schools. Like I said, Santa Clara's a Jesuit school, a fine school. And I was number five. I would believe I was number five in my class. So I had several options. Science was always fascinated me. I was able to master math. And so I believe I was 16 when the United States Geological Survey, I was a sophomore, junior, or sophomore, I can't remember what year, probably junior, they hired me as an intern. And that, I remember my friends telling me, wow, Louis, you go to work and you don't come back dirty. They couldn't believe it that I was actually going to Menlo Park, because I would take the bus from East San Jose to Menlo Park, where the USGS office campus was. And it just, that got me to a place that I had never even in my wildest dreams thought, you know, I could be or you know, experience. Because they started. I was working in like the Redwoods National Forest up in up by Eureka up that way. It was I forgot Crescent City, and we were measuring clear cutting runoff. We were measuring the water runoff. I got to make topographic maps help, and I was a geologic assistant. I was a grunt. That's a fancy name for a grunt, but. So making topographic maps in Mammoth in the High Sierra, the Eastern Sierra, also installing tilt meters, and I got to work on earthquake research involved installing tilt meters along the San Andreas Fault, and so that opened a door for me that just never I you know possibilities, and so I worked at the USGS through college until I. You know, ran its course, and so that I believe it was 19. I was in at UC. I had, because of the geological survey, that's why I went to UC Santa Cruz. They had a very good environment. I forgot the term, the school, earth sciences, and so that was my initial. Field that was gung ho, really committed to becoming a geologist. And then what happened though was South Africa happened, and I got active in the anti-apartheid movement and actually started. I remember, I believe it was 19. It might have been 76. There was a massive protest on at UCSC, and we shut down the campus. Over 500 students were arrested. I was the Minister of Defense or whatever. I led the march and was overseeing security and also the occupation of the administration building, and that was a big. Big fight. It might have been 70. I have to check on the dates because I actually left Santa Cruz the campus. I dropped out in 78 after I returned from Mexico. I was an exchange student, and that's really when I started questioning things more just in depth, because when I went to Mexico, I was in Oaxaca. Of all places, which was under the University of Benito Juarez in Oaxaca, which is the school that we were affiliated with while we were there, they was under military occupation, and there was a whole. In fact, we had went to Guatemala and in Guerrero, state of Guerrero, Oaxaca. There was a lot of students that were disappearing. The schools were there was literally the Mexican army with their automatic rifles occupying the campuses, and so that just blew me away. And then in Guatemala, finding the massacre of the indigenous people had just occurred in Huehuetenango when we after we had arrived, I my whole worldview just was turned upside down. I mean, I knew about the Mexican Revolution, knew about the social problem, the poverty and stuff, but the corruption and the political oppression, the oppression, the class warfare just set me off. So I dropped out and decided I wanted to help agitate the working class, and I ended up getting I tried to get a job at the oil refinery in Southern California, because I had moved to LA to look for to join the working class as a idealistic college a person, that wanted just was sick and tired of how things really were in this country. And I ended up getting hired Pacific Telephone and Telegraph as a splicer in 1979. And then I had broken up with a girlfriend that I had there in East LA, and I moved back north. I quit the phone company, came up north, and walked into the hiring office in the phone company, and they hired me on the spot there as a lineman. And this was also all in 1979, and I was a lineman at Pacific, what became Pacific Bell, for from 1979 until I believe it. I retired after 43 years, but it was 20 from AT&T. I retired losing end of 2022.
So, yeah, go ahead, Debbie.
I had to unmute.
Yeah.
Louis, I'm going to ask a question. If you don't want to answer it, it's fine. During this period, as you're radicalized in Mexico, Guatemala, you're kick lead this big demonstration. There's a lot of activism. Were you part of any organized left group?
No, but good question. That's a fair question. I read Mao, I read Lenin, Stalin. I mean, and I ran with leftists in school. I in fact, I forgot to mention one of my profound experiences that when I worked for the U.S. Geological Survey, I was 18 years old. I remember being in West Virginia. I had never seen poor white people in my life, but I got to work and live with them for months at a time. In fact, I went back to West Virginia at 75 the first time, and later in 76, and I was reading Karl Marx and reading, at 18 years old in West Virginia, with the most impoverished people I had seen in the U.S. And mind you, I'd worked in the fields, had been in, labor camps and but that just blew me away, and I actually shifted from a Chicano nationalist to a class working class view person. So I never affiliated. I read the I never, because of my problem with gangs, I never wanted to join political party. I never joined a I've never been a Democrat, never have, sure as hell never been a Republican. I've always been declined a state, independent, and the same with the political stuff. I read them, but I never joined any. My I have family members. My brother-in-law was a Maoist. I have friends that were Communist Party. I have brothers that were socialist, freedom. Oh, I just I because of that experience with gangs, I just never wanted to pledge my allegiance to any group. I'm more like working class. That's my perspective. But that's a good fair question. I usually get it, but that yeah, I never been a card-carrying member of a party.
So you're back up north, you're working at the phone company. Talk a little bit about your union roots there, your union. What were the seeds of your union activism at the beginning?
So it really was the family. No one had asked me to sign a card. I, you know, first day I came up to the hall when I was hired, signed the card. So I was a union member from day one. I lineman was a great job. I really enjoyed it because you got to use big trucks a lot. You know, every day was a different office view, and because we worked in the mountains, we worked in the city. So it and more importantly, there were some old linemen that were strong union supporters, and so that was a good landing spot for me. But I knew the drill, so I didn't take much prodding. I got active as a I believe that was there was strikes every contract pretty much. I remember 1980, there was one in 83. And I believe 86 might have been the AT&T, the nationwide or the legacy T part. And then 89, we had a huge fight out here. So it was just strike after strike after strike. But I also knew I had to do stuff. So I signed on early as a mobilizer, and that so because one of the things that got me to got me active eventually, I had been moved from one yard to another, and the steward there was such an arrogant, I mean, plus a racist. He wore a Confederate cap. He was a officer in the local, and he actually, it is, I get, give credit to him for getting me to step up and become a steward, because he would tell us stuff that, like I can't tell you. It was bargaining, I believe, in 86. And he just said, I can't tell you. We would ask about bargaining. What's the status? He would come to the yard in a suit, because he liked to impress. He thought he was a business agent, like construction, building trades type, but what really pissed me off was he would use the N-word and other, and it just that just to me that was just wrong as a union rep. And so the guys on the crew were saying, "Hey, Louis, you got a big mouth. Why don't you, put in for being a steward, or what's going you need to do?" And so I got active through that experience with that person. And long story short, I actually ended up helping the guy late years later when I was president, got him up. Anyway, so he got a grievance settled, so he was able to retire. And it was funny. And even one of my kids, he was a baseball umpire, and I saw him years later, and he was called some good for one of my kids playing baseball. So I never hold grudges. To me, the life's too short. My mother had a saying, no te apures pa que dures, don't trip over the stuff you have no control over. So I learned that early on to in life. I don't waste time fighting with peers or holding grudges or stuff. My focus is on, the class enemy, the employer, the corporations, the true, the oppressors. And that's so even though I had a, I knew this guy was not really what a true unionist probably should, didn't reflect that, but still, I helped him out when he needed it, and moved on, after.
So you didn't consider him unredeemable, huh?
No, it was just strange. Everybody's got their own walk
Yeah.
in life or whatever, but no, he actually went on. He got defeated in the next election because him and his slate, one of their, I recall, this was so bizarre. They were filming people working, because that's after divestiture. So a lot of people were side hustling, doing inside wire and stuff, because that was all deregulated. And so their goal was to help the company Pacific Bell. And so they were filming people working moonlighting, and it was like, okay, that's your campaign slogan, ratting out people. Which, although I get it, but that's not,
Yeah.
that's how his mentality,
Yeah.
you fly the Confederate flag and then plus, snitch, rat out people. That thought that was a good, good, I
So,
guess,
talk a little
platform.
bit about the makeup of the local. Was this purely a plant craft local? Was it, were there service
Oh,
reps, operators?
man. So that back then, the local was a lot more diverse. In fact, we had, I believe, at least four operator offices. We had numerous call centers. So in fact, I believe the with the operators, the the call center and the clerical, they actually women and billing, accounting, the females were probably a majority in the local. In fact, during that time in the late 70s, the local transitioned from male to female, and we had female president after female president: Lorraine Weddle, Vera Milarides, Sue Fowler, and then after Sue was Nancy Biagini. And so it, there was a string of female leaders. The local actually then, because of downsizing and closings, has now today it's probably 90% male, and it's really sad to see. There isn't a recruitment focus anymore by AT&T, like they, because they had to because of the class action filed, you know, years in the 70s by women and minorities. So there's no push anymore to bring women into the technical titles. And so it's really unfortunate to see the call center work gone, plus the operator. That's kind of that was a, you know, a service that's really you know, on its last leg. But the call center work, that definitely isn't. But it they've been closed for a number of years now. I can't even remember how far back.
The women you mentioned, were they coming out of the service rep world, out of the operators, or out of technicians?
Very
Vera
few,
Nance.
very
Mark.
few came out of technician. They came out of the billing. They had a huge accounting and billing center. That was the goal. If you wanted more pay, more than the operators, because operators, bless their heart, always, you know, at the lowest level, but they were the badass best ones to picket with. I'm telling you, when I was a steward first became, and I was on a picket line with operators, they didn't mess around. That's where they also know how to spit loogies, because I saw them do that.
So,
I don't remember an 89 strike. Do you
that was the,
remember what it was? Was it just Pacific Bell? Because this was after divestiture. Do you remember what it was about? How long?
yes, we had actually two strikes that year. We actually had, and I may be wrong on the amount of days. I know we had went for out for a couple weeks, then we had gotten a tentative, and then it was voted down. So then we went back out, and then the loan, and the big issues were, I can't recall the huge, it was a, you know, because people talk about the good old days. It's like, damn, I don't know where and when those were, because even when the company was a monopoly, they were bad, they were damn mean and tough and stingy. And so I can't remember all the issue. I probably could find something, so you know what what they are. But then Loma Prieta earthquake happened. Huge earthquake got both sides to the table, and they worked out their differences. It was took an act of God to settle the strike out west, pretty much, because of course it was serious and a lot of loss of life, a lot of damage. So that's what ended up pushing both sides to, you know, to, well, pushing the company to be more reasonable.
So, tell us a little bit about your progression within the local. So you come in, you're a member, you become a mobilizer. Are you a steward at some point? Are there other jobs that you're doing in the local before you get elected to an office?
Yeah, I loved writing, and so I've got a collection of writing, but let me tell you, so I've got a bunch of newsletters and stuff, and one of my proudest achievements was winning the newspaper letter
Oh, wow.
award. You know, when we used to have that competition, but I had written, and I'm gonna show you one is I actually was writing, I read one, but before I get to that, let me share my notoriety, one of my claims to fame with Morty Barr. I believe it was 92, maybe. He came out, I may be wrong. I want to say it's 92. Him and Florence were invited by Janice Wood was the vice president, so that was before Tony Bixler was elected. Jeff, you might remember the year. I don't. But so Morty came out. It was a great honor for the local, and I was a steward already, a rebel rouser, and so I was in the greeting line. He was standing at the entrance with his wife and with the local leaders and with Janice Wood, our VP, district VP. So I'm walking through the line, ready, and I go shake Morty's hand. I go, "Morty, Mr. President, good to meet you. I wish you would resign." And everybody there goes, they're like, "What?" And he goes, so Morty goes, "Hey, let's go outside." And he took me outside because that's Morty, very diplomatic, professional. He wanted to know why would I say that? And I told him, "We should be organizing MCI." I go, "What the hell is the fucking problem with you? MCI is gonna kick our ass, eat our lunch. They're gonna take our business customers. CWA should be organizing on a massive scale." And he started hemming and hawing, saying, "Well, organizing is so hard. Have you ever organized?" I had been on the organizing committee. We're trying to organize a semiconductor. I believe it was National Semiconductor. I can't remember the companies, but I had volunteered, and it was difficult. It was not our main industry. I just the reason, and I'll go back to my father, why organizing was so important. When he was a carpenter, union carpenter, their strategy to deal with the threat of non-union competitor that was just starting to develop in the 80s, after the air traffic controller, that whole Reagan bullshit. A lot of industries were impacted by this, anti-union and non-union stuff, forces. So their solution in the carpenters to control their work was to have everybody, they called them Black Fridays. So they would stop working every other Friday to save the work. That did nothing to organize. So eventually the carpenters did full circle. They had to restructure and get back focus organizing, because they didn't want to deal. A lot of them were immigrants. That's where my father's experience. I knew that we were gonna just, if we didn't organize, we were gonna get our asses kicked eventually. And so I gotta write the log. Part of the problems with the trusteeship is their record keeping. They didn't run they didn't keep tabs of their cash deposits and stuff. So anyway, so that was part of, and in fact, some of my writings in the local, what got attention, what I ran on was organizing and being involved in the community. In fact, yesterday I was the MC at the Lowrider parade, this extreme honor. And it's just because of my continued, no, just from my family to CWA, because so CWA was really what got me involved was the organizing. I always volunteered. I didn't care, let me go, I'll go talk to workers. I would not, even though I was a little introvert, when I was doing the work, I'm not, but the organizing, also the community services, real passion still to this day. But Morty, also one of the credits I give him was lifelong learning. I have never forgotten. I always give him credit, even though I had that. The only critique I had of Morty besides was the foreign policy, the attachment with the Solidarity Center, the because I was also active with the community ending the wars in Central America. And in fact, in 1991, I was part of a delegation of American unionists that went to El Salvador to observe the Civil War truce that had ended the conflict there, and just incredible, horrible tragedy. But that will later come into play with the Union to Union project that was part of the influence. So Marty, in fact, I saw him. That was right before the 96 elections, because I went from steward to president. I don't recommend that path, but that's what I chose. I had a disagreement with Nancy and her regime, and I basically ran against Nancy Biagini, and we're friends. We're both helping each other. It never was personal, like other, some like what happened in this local with the trusteeship. It just we need. I believe still to this day that we need to have a quarter-hour dues increase solely committed to organizing. They're like, what the hell are you guys waiting for? Is that till the last person left to turn off the light? So that 96, like I said, I got elected, and it was on a slate about being more active in the community. I mean, on a platform, being more active, organizing, as well as empowering more transparency, empowering the members. So a lot. I don't know.
So, okay, 1996, you're now president of this local. How big is the local in 1996?
In 96, it was over. It was almost 2,500. It was large. We were 9423 is an amalgamation of six different locals: San Luis Obispo, Salinas, Santa Cruz, Mountain View, and San Mateo all merged with San Jose because they were shrinking. At that time, it was San Mateo hadn't yet merged with us, but we had even additional offices out as well. So it was a fairly large local in the best part of California, the Central Coast.
Yeah. So talk about a little bit about your experience as president then. What were your goals when you got yourself elected?
So I quickly, because I had been an activist, had been been around other groups. In fact, that's one of my recommendations to other CWA activists. Don't just be in the AT&T silo. Work with other organizations so you can glean and learn other leadership quality styles and so on. And so I had been so I brought environmental justice work. I was on the Silicon Valley Toxics Coalition board, as were some of my predecessors, CWA, as well was on the United Way board, and Central Labor Council was a delegate, had been a delegate since I believe the late 80s. So it was just coming together and becoming a more activist. I like Seth Rosen. In fact, he was one of those that I credit giving me more skills, more knowledge, because I remember getting that handout or that it was at a I can't remember what training it was, but it was either you're a service union or organizing union. So try to implement that, carry that vision forward. But we obviously investing in stewards, taking out the mystery of how things work. To me, that's not you don't keep that stuff close to your chest. That's something you want to share, the knowledge, the tool. So one of the first things we did, we started partnering with the CWA Net. I can't remember what it was called at the time. John, what was it? Paul Anderson. And so we established a learning center, compute because computers were just coming out, the internet was exploding. So we had a computer lab in the local where our members could come in and learn how to assemble, disassemble a computer, but also how to use software and all. Yeah, I give that credit for allowing me, like I said, Morty's drive, about lifelong learning. Once that registered, I figured, okay, because I don't think it's one and done. You don't read a book once, reference manual just once, and then that's it. You need to keep going back. And then if there's a newer version or other, books or manuals, then that's, you take advantage, read them. In fact, one of my frustrations right now is that people don't read. They don't read, or they just Google stuff and they get the quick answer and there's no vetting. And so we did the computer center, the lab here, and it was around for about 10 years. We're working in partnership with CWA. I forgot what they called it before CWA Net, but that group and also started tr improving the steward training operation, trying to modernize it. So it was just trying to bring, all the different programs that, especially with the triangle. To me, as I evolved more into a lineman, I like reading schematics or reading just plans that were easy to digest and that you can explain to the working class. It wasn't complicated. It wasn't like a, encyclopedia or something. It just, that CWA triangle to me was the easiest way to describe the pillar programs of CWA and also to the members and get their buy-in. And so that where again, I tried once I, got that, the triangle, concept down is what I try to implement in the local. And that, and that's always easier said than done because, well,
So you're trying to bring the organizing culture into the local. What kinds of successes did you have organizing during that period
so
of time?
the successes from that time are what's gotten the local through its toughest times today. In fact, the local today is probably 50% or maybe 60% telecom, 40% others, because that when I was president, we brought in the airlines because there was a local San Francisco. Well, no, it was 9430, the San Mateo local. They didn't want them. They had tried them. They were so they assigned them to us, and from there we got it was U.S. Airways. But then we got or US West or I forget what, but we ended up with Envoy in Piedmont, which today, 100 members. We also brought in SEIU staff. They were looking for a progressive militant local, and at that time that's what the local was. So and their pay is pretty good, union staff, SEIU. So we have another 100 members there. Also, the substitute teachers at the Pajaro Valley Unified School District, they were looking for to affiliate, and we, brought them in. Another, that's a couple hundred members. So, and then we had probably easily a dozen CSIs. We had, that was a goal. The apprenticeship program was up and running, which we were instrumental in supporting and keeping. Actually, to this day, actually, the local. Was until the last regime was very supportive of the joint apprenticeship training program. So that's the legacy that and it would have and we were also supporting the IBM workers. They would meet here. I was also beginning to work on Google. We had before I left in 2008 we that there was momentum. We were clearly becoming a force to be reckoned with here in Silicon Valley.
And were you guys involved in some cable TV organizing as well?
Oh, yes. In fact, I hate the cable companies more than the phone companies. And I say that though because we tried and tried and came close, but no victory for organizing several times. In fact, that whether we tried with when it was TCI, we tried when it was AT&T, who surprised turned out to be just as bad, if not worse, than TCI. And also when it was Comcast. So we have tried and numerous attempts. Yeah, and I and the members got it. I would explain why we need to organize the industry, and still to this day that's something clearly critical for our union.
So, you're local president from 96 to 2008, and then you become an organizer for the local?
Correct.
Okay.
In 2008, I was starting to lose the flame, the passion, and I had always said I just wanted to run and get out. I liked my job. The lineman job is still one of some of the best times, the camaraderie, but also just the being outdoors, the scenery, just it's cool. So I turned had told the local, I'm just gonna step down. I don't wanna probably, because I ran unopposed for 3 terms. The first term, obviously, there was ran against somebody, but I just wanted to, I didn't want to become a bureaucrat. That was my, I guess what.
So, at some point then you join the staff out in District 9. Who's the vice president then at that point?
Because of politics, I'll be blunt, I was going to run for district VP, but I could sense that it wasn't, I'm not going to have people kiss the ring, and I'm also not going to make, deals and stuff. I had toyed with that, but I could read tea leaves. I got a good gut feeling on things, and so I knew, I wasn't going to do that if I didn't think I could win. And so I wait around. So Tony, we had a love hate relationship, and so the it was because of politics, and I knew I would have kicked ass if they had brought me up earlier. Man, it things, who knows, where, because my passion. So I always ran the mobilization trainings. I always did, they could always call on me when I was president, or not, even before. I was a mobilization coordinator for years within the district, the NCNC, the Northern California Nevada Council. And but it wasn't until I want to say 2011 that I started working as a SIP coordinator for one of the mobilization drive. Formally, they started, because I would do it as a local officer, local president. But when I left, that's when I started getting lost time as a District 9 SIP person.
And so when you come on staff, what kind of assignment do you have there?
So it was largely through the SIFs, either AT&T mobilization or AT&T mobility mobilization. I excel at that. In fact, at one of the Conoctae, or at one of our NCNC steward trainings, I remember Larry Cohen was there. He was a guest. Maybe Jeff, I don't know, can't recall if you were there, but we. So I do this whole like routine on how a march, I mean a picket line looks, just from the inception, and how when you add in, like a drum, or you add in whistles, or just because one of the peeves I got is just people that just picket and picket, and they don't even chant. They're just picketing, or they're just, doing that boring, here we are, troubled, where, no, we, so by what I like is showing the full breadth of options that you can do with mobilization. So we even did had and it took something to imagine technicians learning how to do a skit. We did stuff like that to, in the garages, to get the people excited to laugh, and just like to do, bring in other elements. So in the trainings, that's what I try to do, is to bring in out of the box more, hey, bring in, drums, bring in, instruments, bring in people that, whatever the your audience, the people, that their talents. And so, but Larry, we were even showing, movies. One of the things at the conferences I would do, instead of going out to the bar and just drinking, like CWA do, hey, how about we have a union night, a movie night, and we'd show, Norma Rae, or we show the one in the Mate One, and others, just many, and we talk about them, and then Larry goes, oh man, with all the fights going on and stuff, you guys watching movies? So Larry, this is part of work. What do you think? We don't watch movies at night when we're at home, or working families. That's when we go to the movies, it's just part of that, bringing the working class culture, storytelling, the all the we would even do karaoke. It's like, damn, that's what working people do. We sing, we laugh, we cry, not just march like in a picket, just all pissed off, So that's part of the flavor, part of the perspective. I encourage people to tell their stories. In fact, I still to this day in steward trainings and stuff, that is to encourage people to share, learn their family stories, their union, experience stories, and share them, talk,
That's what we're doing. Yeah, I mean, it does feel different. I mean, you feel more engaged on a picket line if you're chanting or singing or got some kind of special march. I mean, it does engage people more and make them feel more part of a community than just walking around with a sign
Oh
on your
yeah,
shoulder.
and now the local, we've got the best banners. I mean, it's taken the legacy or whatever, the results are evident, because we marched in May Day the last week, and you could see the banners, they were because of they had the tall stick, so that they're raised up, because they're at ground level, you can't see them unless you're up close, but when they're raised up, you can read them. So so I did the SIF, the Save the Copper, which I was reluctant to, because I get the copper, the attachment, but it's a dying technology. But there's nothing as reliable, though, and that's the problem with the I debate with some of the management that I come across these days with grievances and stuff. Like, yeah, you guys don't have a backup, system as reliable as the copper does, and that's the problem, but I became direct, actually hired full time by the district in 2015. I was a SIF coordinator, helped bring in DirecTV. We got it done, and I remember it was like 4,000, almost 5,000 workers. The sad thing is, it's only like 600 today in the bargaining unit in District 9.
It's tough trying to predict where the industry is going. I
Yeah.
mean, and to stay ahead of that curve.
No, that's for sure.
So,
And the staff rep was 2018. The Laura Reynolds was the staff person that brought me up. She was the first one, like I said, because of politics, I suspect. I mean, I had been putting in for staff rep years prior, and like I said, though, no, no grudges.
So, you're sort of in a unique experience right now, and if you don't mind, maybe we can talk a little bit about what it's like to be the administrator of a local. How did this come about?
So the local, after I left, had been gradually descending into just constant infighting. And that happens. I mean, there's a time and place for debate, for election and all that. But it became, I guess, all consuming. In fact, the last several group of officers, that's been just constant going back and forth, filing charges against each other. And And then what also was real unfortunate, the pandemic, I think, also led to some of it because of the isolation and other things that went on because of that. But it was that's why I stepped up. I know Nancy did. She had actually Nancy Biagini had been asked because I hadn't retired yet, or no, I had retired because I retired in February of last year, and then she came on in March. It was a lot for her because she's still very active in the community, and so she in May they asked me to take over, in which I've been here since. But I've given them notice that I can only do this for a month, two more, and that's it. Because you really need a solid team and all that to do the work right. But you know, I'm leaving my mark. The building was allowed to go into a disarray. And the interesting story about the hall, though, let me just mention it. We closed escrow on this hall, which is it was an incredible find. It's a good location, ample room for training and parking and all that for a member to do the work of the union. And the we bought escrow closed on September 10th, 2001. And then on September 11th, we were supposed to close the old hall and then use those monies to drastically pay down the new purchase. And then September 11th happened. We will never forget what happened. Of course, the whole country, the world. So everything turned upside down. That actually led to us losing money on the old sale because it took the real estate market was clobbered all. So we couldn't get the money, recoup the sale that we thought we were, because the other building was owned by the local. But so we ended up having to get a mortgage through the national, which we, you know, had to expect the amount was going to be very, very, you know, small. But because of what happened on September 11th, it didn't work out as planned. So that's our connection, the locals' connection with September 11. We went from one high to one low in like 24 hours.
Louis,
And so, yeah, go ahead, Debbie.
I'm sorry, Jeff. Jeff and you both understand what being a trustee is. Many of the people who hopefully will read this may not understand this. So could you just explain why a local will go into a trustee, what the trustee's role is?
So in our CWA constitution, there's provisions for certain, let's just say, inappropriate actions by local leaders. And when they especially involve monies, one thing I've told local members is we cannot have members' dues money being questioned whether the local has tracking and also utilizing them appropriately. So there's strict provisions in the Constitution. If there's financial misconduct suspected, that the local has to take appropriate actions. And the local in this case did not. They were in fact doing everything else what they could to try to get to the bottom of the alleged financial misconduct, except the CWA Constitution, which has laid out a fair and equitable process with transparency and due process for both sides. And so generally the national union has a right, and like I tell the members in the local, it isn't Local 9423, it's CWA Local 9423, because there's some, you know, that think that the local has full autonomy. They don't. Every organization has rules, has bylaws, has boundaries, and that those are contained in our constitution. In fact, the constitution is the glue that bonds all the locals together.
So, what is the process by which a local is put into trusteeship?
So the local was brought into trusteeship after a executive board poll to support the request to put the local in receivership, and in this case, it was based off of financial allegations of financial misconduct that were not addressed adequately by the local officers.
So the request came from some of the members or leaders of the
Correct.
local
There was, yes.
directly to the National Union's executive board. And
Yes.
that, Jeff, I'm sure you've sat on that many times if you want to add anything to
No,
that.
I think that encapsulates it. I mean, it is typically we see a trusteeship happen for two reasons. One, financial malfeasance, some financial issue that pops up that needs to be addressed, or you just have two sides that just are never going to get along and are just tearing a local apart. And it sounds like you got a little bit of both in this case.
And then the trustee's role is to put things back in order and eventually to so that there could be an election of new leaders.
Correct. So the trustee's role is to secure the finances, all the assets of the local, and to implement all the CWA triangle programs to the best of our ability, but to eventually get the local on solid footing so that it can be returned to the members through an election.
And who makes the decision that it's time to end the trusteeship?
So I've been told that it all rests with me, and
Okay.
although I'm though in con there's a support at national at headquarters, legal as well as staff that support, the efforts right now. At least we have some remaining open issues. There were some DOL, as well as bonding issues, as well as there's still a charge between the officer that needs to be run its course. So those are the things that we're waiting because we want to make sure that any potential candidate is authorized to run, and we'll know that after all these other issues are closed out or resolved.
So to sum it up, this is an internal CWA Constitution process to preserve integrity and a democratic process and financial, what's the right word? Financial, doing the right thing financially.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and
Oh,
what I
thank you.
what thank you. And I'll also state that it's an honor and privilege to be in these positions, and that I've carried that throughout my career, or my time here, and that's truly needs to be known by the members that they can trust their local officers to do the right thing all the time.
Right.
So you sent us over a little timeline of your career, which was very helpful. But in the bottom there, you mentioned some international activities. Can you want to talk a little bit about some of those? I mean, some
I'm
interesting
sorry, I
experience.
had lost the sound for a
Oh,
second. I didn't
okay.
hear the beginning there. Sorry. Yeah.
So I noticed on the timeline you gave us at the bottom there, you listed some international activities. You want to talk a little bit about some of the more interesting experiences you might have had in that regard?
So I will, but are you guys still want to know about local compliment, or is that still there? Or
We want to hear your story. I mean,
oh, okay.
so.
So be all right. So let do the international union stuff because that kind of predates some of the union work I did officially as president. So as I mentioned, El Salvador has been a connection, part of my experience. Based off of the trauma, remember in the 80s, El Salvadorian immigrants were refugees were being settled in our community, and that's led to my awareness. But also prior as a student, when as I mentioned in the 1970s in Guatemala and Mexico. But I also want to mention, though, I did return in 1991 and completed my units I needed. I did graduate thanks to Morty Barr because I kept very lifelong learning. So I did go back, get my degree in Latin American studies. So, but the opportunity arose to go to Cuba as part of America, U.S. United States labor delegation, and I believe that was in 2006. I mean 1996. Sorry, we attended the May Day celebration and the Workers' Congress, and it. I know, as a union leader, I also was open to establishing the just equitable relations with the country in our hemisphere. In fact, when I was a local president, we had raised a motion in a resolution that was one of the other areas where I had a lot of that's a whole nother chapter, the different resolutions, whether it was against the Iraq War or to provide humanitarian food aid to Cuba. Originally, it was to end the embargo, but the convention that year was in Miami, Florida, and there was huge resistance to us raising it. In fact, I remember Morty telling, that they will circle the building and they will shut us down if we propose that. So being the realist, being work pushing hard for the cause, but also realistic, it ended up being a resolution to provide humanitarian aid. And this Southeast District 3 group, at the end of the convention, they did a motion to reconsider, and because most people had already left, their supporters were there, and that resolution was overturned. But I was blessed, fortunate. I went back to Cuba on another opportunity, and to just to experience the harm that the blockade was doing. Still, cause I looked up to Che Guevara as a maybe idealistic young person. I remember seeing his photo in the in a silhouette, one of those famous posters when I was in middle school. That's the first time I learned about Che Guevara, and it's been one of my heroes since. And so I was also able to go to Japan, part of the CWA exchange, and I remember helping District 6. They asked me when I was there if I could go to one of their employers, and said, "Yeah, no problem." So I took some of the Japanese. We'd say, "Hey, I don't know, let's go." Yeah, I have no qualms going and helping other workers. In fact, the local and they remember, I forgot the brother from District 6. When I would see him, say, "Hey, thank you, man, for doing that to help their they were in protracted bargaining." But our local also received delegations from Cuba, from Palestine, from France, from I mean, the list is endless of different work that they knew. We would host them, we would welcome them, and then they would speak to the membership, but we would have a community gathering here to welcome them. In fact, France, I because of our work at Hewlett Packard, we had a bunch of CWA members when I was president, that we had a large presence at that. One of our CSIs worked at throughout Silicon Valley, Hewlett Packard, and was one of the primary places. And they had just bought compact computers, and so the French delegation or French union, it was a CFDT, I believe, the confederation. It was the center left center, not because there's a different. There's left is the communist. There's center right. There's religious right. All these different confederations in France. And so they contacted us. So we worked with them. We hosted them. We did a lot of support for them, and they in turn invited me to May Day over there, and I got a lead a march in Paris, France. Well, not lead, take part with the different unions that worked at Hewlett Packard, and so it was part actually been incredible experience to take part in El Salvador on May Day during a general strike to support the telecommunications workers union. In fact, most of my work has been with telecommunications industry union. And El Salvador was the first May Day as well, of course, Cuba, but also France and that. But the biggest May Day experience, the most Pat, where I actually came to tears, was celebrating May Day in 2006 in my hometown. And this was the crowd. There were estimated 200,000 to 250,000 people took part, and the local was the one of the unions. We had to do security for 50,000 people, and so one of my memories is, and this is a picture I took down from here in the local. But we had a group that never, I mean, it was unbelievable to celebrate May Day in that level in the country I was born, in the town I was born in. But I have to give props to Eduardo Diaz, because the Union to Union International, that when that came about, that really helped transcend and give us, because the unions that I had been act, and I didn't even list all of them, we were able to assist them and send rank and file members to El Salvador. We work closely. In fact, one of the treasured acknowledgments is their gift to me of a plaque of the work that done throughout the years with them. And so, but also the Philippines and Mexico and other, you know, places, primarily the West Coast, the Pacific Ocean rim. But that the Eduardo Diaz Union to Union actually got us more, even I think, to a different level view, a world view, that instead of the leaders going to conferences, giving speeches, which is fine, maybe that's important. I don't, but that having the rank and file actually interacting and understanding that the foreign, you know, other workers are not their enemy. You know, that's really the takeaway that I have. But the Eduardo Diaz, I actually met him in Puerto Rico. I was there actually during the it was a LACLA conference. So I wherever, in fact, my family knows we vacation with a purpose. So when we were in New York, for example, we went to the Occupy Wall Street. I go, we were my son was living in New York at the time, older. So wherever we're at, we don't, if there is we were in the World Cup in South America, we went to see workers' cooperatives in Argentina, or we joined the protests in Rio. You know, we They know, my family knows, we there's no, you know, we don't go to the beach vacation to just lie on the beach and get, you know, get burned. We go, you know, we'll look out, we'll go support union. I will go out of my way to meet a union person. So when we were in Puerto Rico, I went to the Puerto Rican Telecommunications Union, and Eduardo Diaz was there, and I didn't bring the picture, but that was so cool. In fact, that's how we met. And so I, whatever I could do to help the program, the vision that Larry and Eduardo and others had on that. So that's how I got involved, was by random, just happened to be there at that union on the same day Eduardo Diaz was.
Yeah, the two, I mean, between Eduardo and Larry, they've really created a sea change in the way we viewed international relations in the movement. So you were lucky to be a part of that union.
Can I switch a little bit?
Sure.
You say in your bio that you were a member of the Minority Caucus from 1997 to 2009. I'm very interested to hear your thoughts about how CWA as a union, whether you're talking about the local or the national union or the district, both positives and shortcomings in terms of developing equity and leadership for particularly, I think you're the first person that we've interviewed who comes from Hispanic or Chicano background. So I'm interested to hear you talk a little about that.
So Dennis Surrett was another mentor within CWA. In fact, when I first met Dennis, I told him, "Hey, I voted for you, bro. I voted for you." Because I remember I was always looking for third party or other candidates, but I remember seeing the bio phone worker, but union member. I go, "Man, I didn't even think twice and voted for him." But he recognized that the often we're a reflection minorities of our experience. And one of the frustrations I had with CWA is just it's the black and white nature of relations. Everything was either black, African American, or white, Anglo, just that was there was no there truly is no welcoming like space. Even the minority caucus, why I'm not a longtime member of them, because I just don't I disagree with the a lot of the planning. I didn't want to go to a dance all the time. That's to me is not there's so important work that needs to be done. Not that that's all they did, but they didn't reflect the minorities in the country, their leadership, and also their the focus of the workshops. And so I remember working with Dina Beaumont and others and Yvette Herrera to try to, I did when asked, I would always volunteer if you want to hear, learn about Latino Chicano working class history, no problem. I can handle that. So I ran with Dennis. I was part of a slate, and that's why I give credit to him because, he had an important role, influential role in the formation of the minority caucus. And he recognized too that at some point, that truly to live up to its mission or to reflect that title, it should be open to more. And so he had a diversity slate where there was a couple of Hispanics, there was a couple, there was a gay white male, as well as African American. And we unfortunately lost. But that just was again, count me in. I
This
was
was a
definitely.
slate for the minority caucus.
Correct. Yeah. And
And
it,
this
I,
must have been with Dennis back in the late 80s or 90s.
late 90s. Yeah. It was, I remember in District 9, it was when the election took place at Anaheim near Disneyland. And there was some stuff that went local, brought in all kinds of members, signed them up the day so that, or previously, so that they could vote. And, that's powers of numbers, But to this day, that's a disappointment. Not that leadership is everything, but there seems to be gaps, not only with the Hispanic, Latino, but Asian as well, Americans who are, just worthy, as well as others. But it seems to me the best way I'd characterize it, which is true in a lot of areas of the country that I visited, I've been traveling since I was a young man. It just seems that unless you're on the news, the Latinos especially are invisible. We're like they used to call us the sleeping giant because we didn't vote in our numbers, we didn't get the recognition our numbers deserve and stuff. But it is a disappointment that CWA. If you look at the board today, I believe there's 1.5 Latino there, but not to disparage anyone, but that it is it's pretty slow, and at the pace CWA is doing, it'll be another 100 years before there's probably true reflection of minorities. Which I understand the open seat concept, all of that, but it taking forever to get really, to live to showcase the diversity of our true diversity of our union. Yeah.
Did you support the at-large diversity seats? And you're implying that you think it hasn't made enough of a difference.
Well, there's only 4 seats, so and they are limited, but they have not. I mean, look, today they're 4 African Americans, which they deserve to be on there, but again. If you look at the board at large, I remember when women were very few to be found. I remember when African Americans, but now, again, But I guess the point is that it's just taking a lot longer than maybe to evolve, to that point. And there's no, I don't think, quota or anything like that. I'm not, I'm not thinking that that's the solution. But again, I think it's the lack of support. I had toyed with others establishing a Latino caucus at one point, but I knew my time wasn't, as leadership wasn't gonna, was nearing its end, so that we didn't, it didn't come, to fruition. But that's another regret, not establishing a clearly an organization, because the numbers warrant it. If you look, especially the Southwest, many other parts of the state, there the Latinos are huge, and they're a big part of the membership, in many states.
Yeah.
Louis, what are the numbers? When you first started working, your local was about how many people, and now what is the numbers?
So it was, I believe, about 2,500. We represented about 2,500 at that time. I would say probably 75% was white, 25% minority. In fact, the crews that I was on were mostly were mostly white, until over time, it just grad as retirements happened, it started changing. Today, the membership, sadly, is probably at 1,000. In fact, part of the duties I'm doing as TA is we're gonna have to adjust the number, officer number, because they have not been organizing. Attrition has overtaken any growth, and it's just it's not just it's not a good situation. But today the membership is probably the reverse, probably 75% minority, 25% white, maybe a little, maybe 60-40. But I just b get based off of a lot of the data I'm seeing. That's a guesstimate. I don't have actual numbers, so.
So you talked a little bit about a disappointment there in your career with not starting a Latina conference or
Caucus,
caucus.
Latino
Yeah,
caucus, yeah.
caucus. Yeah. Tell us, over the course of your career, what are you most proud of? What's the thing that you really think, I left my mark?
So one of them is this. It's reversed, but it was in the CWA News from April, May 2003. And the title was CWA Wins Major Overtime Settlement at SBC. So I'm proud. When I do steward trainings, I always acknowledge the role CWA had in my development, the trainings. I've been a sponge throughout my career. Whatever I learned, I keep the books. I'm a union hoarder, I guess. I got my wife would attest to that. And so we won a grievance. Our local was the leader, lead local, and of the Bay Area locals that won several million-dollar. Well, first the grievance was $1 million, and that was because there was on behalf of 267 members, and our local 9423, we had about 100 of them were out of my local. And so one of the things I gotta mention, the highlight is I never did any of this alone. It was always the other officer. I mean, it just I got the recognition, got the pictures. I mean, I was always in the CWA News. That was a joke. When they're looking at me, but it was the local, the members, the rank and file that really stepped up, that took to heart or were empowered through the committees and other thing to tools to influence the outcome. But this overtime settlement, the original grievance was $1 million. The arbitration was another $1 million. So it's to the day one of the largest, if not the largest, at least in our district, several million dollar. And that, mind you, was back in back in 2003, 20 years ago. So you can imagine the dollars what they're worth today. But it was the stewards. It was the stewards doing the legwork, doing the other officers taught local. And when I came in, local training program was expanded. So stewards, we had in-house additional training to supplemental training, advanced training, and so on. So taught bargaining. In fact, I went on to teach at the local community college labor studies program, bargaining and mobilization. And because it shouldn't be a best kept, secret. It shouldn't be a mystery. So that's been a goal, and it showed, it bore fruit. That was I think one of the top, achievements was that grievance settlement and arbitration settlement because of the work that the members of the stewards had done and the other officers. Another milestone was the May Day celebration. In fact, our local CW, this local was one of the was one of the regulars. We were could be counted on to assist the community, but marching with that 250,000 people was another incredible highlight of the time that I spent here. As well, there's a few other, the safety as well, the focus, and that's Dave LeGrand. Again, appreciate, we don't do this work alone. And so Dave has, and he's out here in California. Just I don't have time to fit even, like, man, this job now it's full time and then some. But the safety was huge. In fact, this is one of my favorite posts that I learned from Dave LeGrand. But it says, don't forget, safety first, quality second, productivity third, every job, every time. And that was the CWA safety and health program, which again, I know we're all struggling with resources and all that, but that we used to have a kick-ass safety and health program that was tops. And so that also having been able to instill in the local. While I was here, now we're having to rebuild it. We've lost, so many locals are struggling. The committees are not up and running. Safety and health is critical. But let me show you this. This is one of my favorite pictures of my time as a, I don't know if you can see. So Larry Cohen had come out here for a rally, but that my daughter, she's now a nurse. She was one there. I think she's 31 now. So it's always been a family affair. My kids grew up on the picket line. They knew, if, in fact, I would tell them that when they became teenagers, if you want to eat, better damn go with dad. That's where the food comes from, the picket line. But I got to tell you one story. One year, my wife came in. She was, because we always did our own yard work and stuff, and chores was always, part of our family structure. But she was like beet red, ready to laugh. She goes, "You better go outside. Something's happening out there." So I go out there, and our kids are picketing. They're saying, "End child." They had signs. They had made signs that said, "End child labor." They were marching down up in front of our house. And that was before social media and all that. I mean, because now our oldest is 42, but that was hilarious. So I know I di digress, but anyways.
Hoisted on your own petard.
How did that end? Did you negotiate? Did you sit down at a bargaining table?
So I did. I said, those that are under 16, yeah, you can go in and have your lunch and water break and all that. The rest of you got to continue working. But yeah, that was all.
Well, Louis, this has been great. Hannah, Debbie, do you have anything else you want to pop in with?
Sure, I can ask a couple questions.
Great.
So Louis, you talked about one of your proudest achievements was encouraging a more engaged and active picket line with music and chanting and all that sort of stuff. Do you have any memories of maybe like one picket line that was really robust, and can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so it was the 2004 strike. And by the way, that was another milestone. That was the 4-day strike. Maury Barr had called a 4-day strike. And we had, I don't know, I'm a stickler for facts. And if you give me a plan, you say this is the timeline, that's all I need. So the mobilization for power guideline, which I always give credit to CWA, is the book for all of labor today. In fact, the UAW, if you look at how their strike, how they won, it was following the CWA model, the playbook. And so the 2004 strike, we had gotten a year out, had started doing the work. So by the time that strike, when expiration had come around for the contract, we were ready to go. And one of the things, lifelong learning, I learned from Morty. I got my radio broadcaster license through, it was an employer-funded program, training program that CWA negotiated. So I took advantage of that. I got my FCC license, did a radio DJ license, and so we were. And the radio station I work for covers most of the local. So on one Saturday morning, I was broadcasting union picket sign, picket music, related music, and it was being played on all of our picket lines in the Central Coast area of California, because I'm a radio DJ at KKUP, which is a non-commercial community radio station. And so everybody was dancing and doing conga lines, and so it was, and everyone was listening to the same radio station. So I was able to give them shout outs and talking about SBC corporate greed and this and playing, dedication. So that was the memorable. In fact, the member, some of the old timers, they say, "Oh yeah, I remember your voice." I was able to broadcast to them, which is the importance of media. Why we gotta. And I'm glad that the CWA Human Rights has got into a committee into radio, because it's an important medium and a real important tool. But yeah, that was a memorable strike, and also being able having all the picket lines with the same with the boom boxes playing and all celebrating together, the strike.
What was your DJ name?
Well, I'm Lowrider Louie, so that's my actually yeah that's it's my
If you see his Facebook page, you'll understand
yeah.
Do you remember any of the songs that you played?
One of the was Dr. Loco's Rockin' Jalapeño Band, picket sign. That was one. That was going up because it's actually an old farm worker UFW song that he updated and added lyrics to and stuff. And the other one was El Raton, the Rat, and that is a Fania All Stars classic, which went out to to SBC management. So that was a good. That was a good. We, yeah, because I think they had a rat too in one of the pickets. So that was a good
I
time.
would love at some point if you could email us all the photographs that you had, and if you want to send us your playlists, that would be a great thing as well.
I would try. Yeah, I don't know if I have that, but I do have. I want to send you this letter because it's pretty. Maybe it's it just it it it's titled, and this is the article why I believe I won the award for, and it's about subcontracting. And it's but I'm gonna send you. I've got some of the writings, and again, you can see. I know it's reverse. It's not. I don't have the, but I've got some, and that will give you more. I even wrote about one of the trips to El Salvador, and so again, it just that yeah. Whatever I can find, Hannah, if you want, email me after, and I can see what additional items I can find. Definitely, it's an honor. CWA, I tell members why I came back, because they I've been part of CWA a little longer than I've been married with my wife, and that's true. And that This union is touch has influenced so many, and I'm forever grateful. In fact, my kids know, they know CWA, they know union, and they know, because that, like, it's not just me, it was the family experience, community, as well as the members. The members have really been the highlight of all of this, just seeing their transformation, seeing their sacrifice and humility, and we do it, we do this work for them.
Hannah, thank you so much for asking those questions.
Thank
You
you.
said you were
Thank you.
grateful to the union. We're grateful to have had you, and especially grateful for these past 2 hours plus. It's been a real, the time's flown by. So thank you for this, Lori.
Absolutely.